talked about various the creation and consolidation. You talked about how Mid-Continent would put branches basically in strip malls and pre-existing locations like the Carnegie Building. What led to the building of all of our wonderful branches and that campaign and the aches and pains and then I guess joys that came out of that?
Sure. Well, I think that really is a good setup for how everything happened. You know, as a young library system, really this is true of any young enterprise. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's a for-profit or a business or whatever, you need to keep your overhead as low as possible. And you can't necessarily afford to own all of your physical plant straight out of the gate. And that was definitely the case with Mid-Continent. Remember that unlike a lot of library systems, Mid-Continent is basically only 50 years old. That makes us the youngest of the library systems in the greater Kansas City area.
I had no idea Kansas City Public was that old.
Yeah, Kansas City Public is ancient in terms of its age. Johnson County Library is approaching its 75th anniversary, and I'm not really sure about where they are in terms, but I'm sure that they've got libraries that predate the 75-year age, and certainly Olathe Public Library is older than that, and you know North Kansas City Library was older. And then even when we did have an established area like the WPA libraries in Platte County, they were kind of inadequate, woefully inadequate. They were kind of like volunteer space and things like that. So you had to kind of figure out where you wanted to be. And also demographics and statistical and data-driven decision-making and things like that that we use today was really in its infancy. I mean, if you could get your hands on a computer, it was going to be, you know, the size of a small house, and it would have the processing power of a pocket computer, a pocket calculator today. And so you really couldn't do a whole lot of that data-driven decision-making. I mean, I remember stories, urban planners talking about getting rides in helicopters and driving, you know, flying around and trying to figure out where are the churches, where are the schools, and where are the McDonald's in order to determine where to put city services. That was a standard SOP back in the late 60s and early 70s. And so it was really a by guess and by gosh. And so one of the things that Jim Leathers came up with was this idea that because you didn't want to, you know, immediately sink a bunch of money into building buildings, you wanted to build your service up first and then maybe look at buildings. He started looking at renting storefronts. And so the idea is that you'd find space somewhere in a growing area, theoretically, because you wouldn't build a strip mall in a place that's dying, hopefully. And remember, we're talking about 1960s. So these, you know, strip malls were coming up all over the place with the grocery store on one side, maybe a hardware store or a drugstore on the other side, and then like a TG&Y and, you know, yarn stores and things like that in the middle. And they're popping up everywhere in our footprint. And so then the idea was to find where those were, put a library in there, see if it works. If it works, great. And maybe you rent more storefront, more square footage. If it doesn't work, no big deal. No harm, no foul. Just pick it up and move to the next strip mall and maybe it'll work better there. And so that was the model really for Mid-Continent for many, many years. And there was lots of pluses and minuses with that. So, you know, some of the pluses is that it really allowed Mid-Continent to never move into a really big fleet of bookmobiles. We had a couple of bookmobiles. And in fact, I remember using the Mid-Continent bookmobile when I was a kid. And a lot of people still have fond stories about the Mid-Continent bookmobile. But I think we only had two, maybe three total, where St. Louis County had fleets of these things. And the reason that we approached this differently is because the idea was you could rent a small storefront and it didn't move. It wasn't on wheels. I mean, if it was Wednesday and you wanted to go to the library, you go to the library. You didn't have to wait for it to come to your parking lot on Thursday. And all things being equal, especially once gas started increasing in price in the 1970s and insurance started increasing and all of that, it was cheaper to rent a storefront than it was to actually have a fleet of bookmobiles. So we avoided the sort of bookmobile trap that a lot of people got into in the late 60s and early 70s by using this strategy. The other advantage, as I'd mentioned before, is it allows you to be really flexible. If it doesn't work here, you can move there. And probably one of the best examples where that happened was in South Kansas City for a lot of some good, some bad reasons. We had libraries. At one point, we had libraries in Boone Elementary School, in Ward Parkway Shopping Center. We had a library at, I think it was about 72nd and Troost. And these are just the ones that I'm just ticking off the top of my head. There were more. There were a lot more. And some of these libraries, actually the one at 72nd and Troost, wasn't in our library district. It was actually in the Kansas City Library District. Ward Parkway was in a shopping center, sort of followed that shopping center model. Yeah. Boone Elementary School was actually in a school, which was not an ideal situation for us. But as a lot of the, you know, as we started having white flight, started having lots of issues in the 1970s with depopulation of some of that area around Fairyland Park, that's kind of where that was. A lot of those started decreasing in utilization. And so we ended up consolidating a bunch of them and, you know, getting the ones back in our district that needed to be in our district. And then also consolidating the ones that sort of decreased in utilization. And they all came together in the Robindy branch, which is near Blue Ridge Boulevard. And it's now our Blue Ridge branch.
That was my branch as a kid.
Yeah.
I walked there. Robindy,
which Robindy also follows that model. I mean, it was in a strip mall. It was actually in the basement of a strip mall, but it was
like back behind. It was right. Almost hidden back there.
Almost couldn't find it. Yeah. And so that was SOP for a lot of our libraries, just renting space, renting space in old roller skating rinks. That was one of the things we liked to do because roller skating rinks are excellent because there aren't any like, you know, piers in the middle of the floor so that you can put it in a lot of shelves and you don't have to worry about that. But because it's rented space, one of the things that you can't do is really create intentional space. So you can't create programming space because you can't build walls because you're going to leave, right? And you can't really do anything permanent because you're going to leave one day. Or even worse, the landlord might actually get somebody who can pay more, at which point they just won't renew your lease. And in some cases, that happened with us. In some cases, we had bad landlords, almost more like slumlords, you know, where we would have leaking roofs and they wouldn't do anything about it. And, you know, sometimes we have roof leak problems now. I mean, that's non-unique. I mean, it happens with us. But at least we have someone that can call and, you know, we can work on it. And so when you're sort of under control of your own destiny, when you own your own roof and you own your own parking lot. And so that was another thing that was really advantageous. But certainly one of the unique situations that we ran into in terms of rental was at Excelsior Springs. And it was actually it was the first building that we built coming out of the building program, in part because of the unique situation that occurred there. And what had happened is that the library was in the, I think it's called Crown Hill Shopping Center is what it was called. It's there at Jesse James and just, it's like the big old strip mall. You'll notice it if you're driving through Excelsior Springs. And we had moved there after we left the Carnegie, in part because the Carnegie needed work and it's not where, you know, people were leaving downtown. They kind of had their own sort of suburban flight issue in Excelsior Springs, as small as it is. And people were moving out to where, you know, sort of out of the downtown area and closer to where the grocery stores and everything were, which was outside that, the downtown area. So we moved there. At one point, I think we looked at getting additional space and we couldn't get additional space adjoining. And so what ended up happening is we had the library and then we had another service of some sort. I mean, could be a, you know, hair salon, whatever. And then the next one that we had was the library. So it was two non-adjoining spaces. And basically what they ended up doing is using the non-adjoining space as a closed stack. So what you do is you would, you try to find your book. If your book wasn't on the shelf, then they'd send somebody over to the other storefront to page the book and bring it back to you. And so that, you know, less than ideal situation. As, as I talked about the development of the Clay County Library, Kearney and Smithville were among the first libraries established in Clay County, and they were established in storefronts. One of the interesting things is that the big strip mall, the big brand new strip mall in Smithville at the time, was right at the, right on the banks of one of the tributaries of the Platte River, which every time someone spits in the Platte River in those days, it would flood. I mean, it didn't take any level of water for the river to flood. And one of my favorite stories is that Joel Philbeck, he was the North area administrator, associate director for public services, in those days. And he said every spring they went up to Smithville and took all the books off the bottom two shelves and took the card catalog and set it up on top of a table just in case. And one day, and all this, you know, before the building of the Smithville Dam, after the building of the Smithville Dam, this has, you know, all been sort of old news. But, one day, they forgot or didn't get up there fast enough, or someone spit in the river, one of the three things, and it flooded, and it flooded the entire shopping center. It flooded the library. The library was, the first two, shelves all the way across was underwater. They had to, of course, withdraw all those materials. It is a way to weed your collection. It's not the way that I would suggest you weed your collection. But that was one of the issues. So Smithville was another one that we built pretty quickly. And one of the ways that Paul White, one of our directors, used to always say is that Mr. Ferguson and the library staff back then used to always say that they were afraid of Indian attacks because they always put their libraries on high ground so that, you know, they could see them coming. It really wasn't because of that. It's because of floods. It was all the floods that we always had. So if you look at where Old Smithville is, you know, where even New Smithville, it's setting way up on a hill. And in fact, that's true of a lot of our buildings. During the flood of 93, the Riverside branch, the old Riverside branch would have, the rented space would have been flooded during the flood of 93. That building did flood during the flood of 93. But our new Riverside branch sets almost as high as you can get in the city of Riverside. And although you couldn't get to the branch was absolutely fine.
Circulation went down.
The circulation did go down during the flooding period. Yeah. So there was a lot of reasons. I mean, by this point, the library had gained a certain amount of maturity in terms of, you know, it had books, it had collections, it had a little bit of length in its longevity, and it had a very successful summer reading program by that time. There were lots of positive things going on. And so it seemed, and by that time, it was a little bit more predictable as to growth patterns too. Maybe not growth rates, but growth patterns. You kind of knew which cities were going to grow next and all of that. At that point, in the 1980s, there was an issue with our operating levy, and part of that involved just inflation and just not keeping up and all of that. Also, the new Hancock Amendment that was in place made it a little bit harder to capture inflation as quickly as it would rack up. So the library was looking at increasing its levy, its operating levy, just to make ends meet. I mean, there are terrible stories that Tom Lane and Mr. Ferguson told me about waiting for the delivery to come in to the headquarters building so that they get the fine money and deposit the fine money so the checks wouldn't bounce that day. I mean, it was really, really tight cash flow at that particular time period. You'll hear branch managers that were around in those days that talked about how, book selection was pretty much non-existent. Basically, what happened is that the library would get a copy of books, and that one copy is the only book that the entire library system would get. So no MRAs, no three requests for every one copy owned. It's just one copy, because that's all they could afford. And so they looked to put an operating levy on the ballot to try to address the operating shortfall. And then also because of the maturation and the slowdown and all of that, they looked at creating a building levy. And the building levies in Missouri for Missouri libraries can be 10 years. So this went on. It was originally set up as a 10-cent building levy, but the Hancock Amendment rolled it back. And then I think it rolled up a little bit. But basically, we collected money for an additional levy for 10 years to build the library buildings. We also increased our operating levy at the same time. It had been 25 cents. We raised it to 35 cents. And then it got rolled back, I think, to 24 due to the Hancock Amendment, which has always puzzled me. I mean, if you went to the voters and said, do you want to be taxed 35 cents? And they said, yes, it seems like that should be the answer. You shouldn't have to roll it back. But they did. But that was fine. I mean, even with that, that gave them more than enough money to operate. And it also gave them the opportunity to start building buildings. And as I said before, the first one that they sort of put out to spec, they did in a real traditional way. They hired a general contractor and had an architect and put together stuff. And as soon as they put together everything, they realized that they wouldn't be able to build half the buildings that they planned on building. The promise was to build or renovate 24 buildings, because that's what we had at that point. This was even, I guess we weren't counting Lone Jack at that point, because I guess we weren't sure what was going to happen with Lone Jack. But the promise was always 24 libraries is what they were going to do. And they determined that they wouldn't be able to do half of them if they did this under a traditional method. And so So Mr. Ferguson, who was he was engaged with the community and certain aspects of the community. He was on a hospital board and things like that. And he was talking with an acquaintance of his that knew a few things about this and that. And they recommended, well, why since you guys have to build so many libraries, you know, you're going to build all these libraries and you're going to average over 2 libraries a year. If you're going to do it over the 10-year span of the levy, why don't you just become a construction company? Why don't you hire a general contractor, make them part of your staff, and then instead of putting this out to bid to a GC, you just do it? And it's like, well, gosh, that's a really interesting idea. And so so they did. They hired a fellow named Luzon Maxwell, and Max built it was fun to ride around town with Max because, as you're riding around town, he'd start pointing at buildings and he'd say, you know, I built that one. I renovated that one. You know, I did a plumbing job on that. I mean, cause he built half of Kansas City. He was a CB from World War II. So he kind of knew how to, not only did he know how to build buildings, but you know, if you were a CB, you knew how to build buildings really fast because you were island hopping and stuff like that. You also knew that, you know, you were island hopping. So whatever you built probably didn't have to stand in 5 years. And we are discovering some of those gifts that Max left for us. But with this in hand, we got an architect under contract and we really beat up the architect. And one of the things that architects like to do is they like to create flourishes and they like to create artistic details in your buildings. And we said, no, none of that. We said, you can do something with the outside, but otherwise the inside is going to be a wide open box. There can be a librarian's office. There can be a workroom. There can be restrooms, but that's it. No fountains, nothing.
I don't know, something in the middle of the library that
right.
The reading child.
All straight walls. Minimal finishes, because part of the idea was you would build this as minimal and as open as possible to then sell it and move to the next location. And you didn't want to build this as just a library. I mean, you can see some wisdom in that as you look at the Kansas City School District and they're trying to liquidate these school buildings. I mean, what do you do with a school building once you no longer have school in it? If you built a museum type library, like the perfect lime. I'm not exactly sure what that would be, but if you built something that was so intentional as a library, you may never be able to liquidate it as anything except a library. And so the idea was build them open and build them generic. And so that way you could easily, move them to other places. And so Excelsior Springs was one of the first, Platte City, Smithville, were among some of the other ones. Smithville, as I mentioned, was devastated by flood. Platte City was sort of hopping around downtown following a fire. There was a lightning strike on the top of the building at next door to the Platte City building, and it jumped into the Platte City Library and burnt it to the ground. And so because it had been jumping around from location to location, that was another one that sort of had a need to get a permanent home pretty quickly. And then, of course, we had the lease issue with Excelsior Springs, which made them, you know, an early candidate. There was a lease issue with Antioch. And Antioch was in several places in the basement, in the Antioch Shopping Center, near a bowling alley at one point, which, yeah, again, not really conducive to libraries. Being next to bowling alleys, it's not a good use. It was also near a pet store, and lots of times pets would escape from the pet store and get in between the walls and down by the library. And so that was, issues that we were looking to resolve. And so Antioch was another one that was early on the list. in part because the home wasn't ideal for them. Their rented space. And Blue Springs South was just called Blue Springs back then. I don't think that there was as much of a lease issue there, but at that point, Blue Springs was growing exponentially. It was growing really, really fast. And so it was another one that was built pretty quickly, shortly after the levee.
Platte City, that burned down in the 70s, it looks like.
Right.
So what was probably... So Excelsior Springs was the first.
Yeah.
I think it's like 1986, I believe, that one was built. Having been to most of the branches, and if you go into any Mid-Continent branch, there is a little plaque or little signage on the wall that says what year it was built. Was there a race of some sort to, we have 10 years, 9 years, 8 years, build, because it seems like the 1990s, there was this boom of branches being built in rapid succession.
Mm-hmm. Well, part of it is that when you pass a building levy, building levies can only be used for capital expenses. And so, you can't use it for anything except building or, the furnishings within a building. It's the only things that you can actually use for those expenses. Now, once collected, if you can keep them properly segregated, and that's the way we used to do that through an account, there was a special building account. It was still in existence when I was the finance manager briefly. I think I closed it out because it was just sitting there with no money in it, but it was still in existence. But if you keep your money segregated and use it for the purposes of building, then that's, obviously a good thing. The other thing is that, part of the motivation behind doing this was to get out of the leasing world and to stop leasing buildings and stop leasing space. And so part of the motivation to do this quickly was to, so that we weren't paying lease and, leases and just throwing money away when we knew that eventually we'd be building buildings. So I think that was another reason why it was so fast. The other thing I think too was that it sort of kept momentum going. And so as you finish the one set of drawings, you start on the next set of drawings, and as you bid out the first masonry contract, all the masons know that there's going to be another masonry contract coming out in 6 months, and so they keep looking for your work, keep looking for your requests, and so you're not constantly having to sort of rattle the cage to get people to bid on your stuff. That has actually happened to us a couple of times here recently with some of our recent building projects where we've had to sort of entice people or encourage people to bid on our projects. And that wasn't so much the thing back when we were doing that, because they constantly, every 6 months, every 3 months, a new project was coming out. They knew it was coming out. They were keeping their eyes open for it. They were getting us good deals because they knew there was going to be another one coming out and someone would try to undercut them for that one. And so, I think that's where a lot of that came from. Also, there was some batching of ordering some of the capital. So, like shelving, for example, I'm trying to remember, there's three branches that have a particular brand of shelving that just absolutely stinks. And if I remember right, it's Blue Ridge, South Independence, and Lee Summit have that particular brand.
So pay attention to the shelving the next time you go in.
Well, no. Seriously. I mean, well, if you pay attention to the shelving relative to when the building was built, you'll notice everybody in sort of that basic area, that basic timetable, has the same shelving. And it's because lots of times those were sort of bunched together to make a more attractive bid package, and then we would just hang on to the shelving. Now, a couple of things that we discovered by doing this is applying economy of scale, acting as our own general contractor, and just the general economy, because we're talking about, the mid to late 1980s, where the economy was much more robust than it was in the early 1980s. Because of all of those things, we ended up with a lot of money in the building program fund, a lot more than we thought we did. So not only did we do the 24 that we initially promised, we also did, in addition to the headquarters building, which that was not part of the original deal. We also did we did Loan Jack, we did the 25th branch, which was not part of the original deal. We, in addition to the new buildings, we added on to Smithville, Platte City, and Redbridge. I think those were the only additions that we did on top, because there's the normal building program, and then we did the additions on top of those normal building programs. And then by about that time, the building levy retired, and there was still a considerable amount of money in the building fund. And because there was so much, I mean, considerable amount of money in the building fund, and because there was so much money in the fund that could only be used for capital expenses for building, they built Blue Springs North, Colburn Road, Claycomo, and Boardwalk out of those funds. So brand new units of service, and the first new units of service at Mid-Continent since Lone Jack, those were built out of that fund. We also built in addition to the Blue to the Buckner branch, but that was actually a donation. We built the genealogy and local history department wing of North Independence out of those funds, and I think we made an addition or we made a renovation to Weston. That was part of the promise for the building program. But we discovered that renovation wasn't adequate. And then the other issue that we had was that it was about, I think it's about 3,000 square feet, 1,500 on each level. It was a two-level building. And one of the issues that we had with that was that there was no way to put an elevator in the historic district of Weston easily. And so this is post-ADA. Before the renovation, the ADA wasn't in effect. And so we built an additional Weston branch on top of the original promise of a building. I'm trying to remember if we did any other additional branches as, you know, just extra money that was in the funds. I'm not thinking that we did. But there were additional buildings that were built afterwards, but these were what I'm talking about here is just extra money that was left in the building fund. That was mostly appreciated through sort of a Spartan architectural approach. Economy of scale and bulk building, and the fact that we acted as our own general contractor, all those things really did help considerably in terms of you know, stretching the dollar as far as possible.
I'm kind of curious what the public reaction would have been to some of this.
You know, back then, Mid-Continent really did have a strong value of equality and equal service. So the way I described it, and actually I've written about this a few times, the way I would describe it back then is that, well, the way Dick Wilding used to always describe it was that Mid-Continent was like McDonald's, and he's right. That's a good one. I always like to liken it more like a Starbucks. And here's the reason why, that if you go to any big city and you see a Starbucks, you know that almost every Starbucks in every town is exactly the same. You can get the exact same drinks. There's absolutely no difference whatsoever. Every so often you'll run into a Starbucks that has a Clover brewing system, but that's about it. That's the extent of the difference. And if one Starbucks gets incredibly busy, they don't build onto the Starbucks. They just rent space across the street from it. I mean, literally across the street. That's the way Mid-Continent Public Library was, that we were all exactly the same in terms of the services that we offered. In some cases, this was in many cases, this was positive, because what it meant was that when you went to a library like in Northern Platte County or Eastern Jackson County or, you know, sort of our outlying branches, they didn't feel like they were getting the short end of the stick. They realized, hey, I'm getting the exact same thing that they get at Antioch or North Independence or Lee Summit. But the problem was that people in Antioch and North Independence, Lee Summit, were looking at Kansas City Public, Johnson County, and going, gee, why can't we have cassette tapes? I mean, this is, you know, 1988. Why can't we have cassette tapes? And it's like, well, you know, because we can't have them at Platte City, so you can't have them at North Independence. This really got underscored at one point when we were starting to automate. And, you know, we were the last of the library systems in the greater Kansas City area to automate. And part of it was because of this sort of value of everything being equal. We really couldn't get data lines into the little places. And I remember the things Paul White asked me when I was at library school was, you know, he posed the question, if you cannot get data lines and cannot get data lines down to the server in Independence, how would you run an automated library system? And so, you know, I got to thinking about it and came up with these ideas of spinning off CDs and, you know, sending up CDs that you could sort of search individual CD databases, and then you'd have to marry up the data every night and things like that. I mean, it's the only way you could do it. But that was kind of holding us behind in some ways. And so it's one of the reasons why I've really tried to embrace a value of fairness as opposed to equality. And so the idea is that, you know, maybe a certain library needs a service or doesn't need a service. And if they need a service, then let's figure out how to do it. If they don't need a service, then let's not hold up everybody else just because they don't need it, but somebody else does. And so there were some issues. I mean, I think everybody was happy with what they got, particularly with what they had. I mean, because what they had was, you know, shared space that, you know, lots of times there wasn't adequate story time space. Sometimes there was no story time space. That they were all almost all of our libraries had VCT, vinyl tile, which meant when you rolled the book trucks over it, it was really, really loud and really noisy. And of course, everything bounced off of it because it wasn't carpeting. You know, sound bounced around in those areas. The lighting was always really super harsh. Actually, our new building lighting wasn't much better, but at least we controlled it. So maybe that made it better. I don't know. But I think most people were really happy with what it was that they were with what it was that they were getting. I mean, they didn't feel like we were overbuilding or necessarily underbuilding. And certainly when you were comparing it to where they were coming from, I think they were pretty happy with the result. But one of the things that ended up happening is, you know, of course, most of these buildings were designed or conceptualized in the mid-1980s. So this is sort of pre-internet, pre-ILS, and not a whole lot in terms of, well, it was pre video as well. I mean, there's no visual collections really per se. A few libraries, South Independence, for example, had a record, an LP record collection, but most of our libraries didn't have records because LP records, I mean, as volatile as CDs are, cassettes were more volatile and LP records were incredibly volatile. So we just didn't have those. I mean, they weren't really good collections for loaning. And then of course, computers and the internet and things like that weren't really around. Or if you did have computers were very expensive. What you would do is you would end up with, you know, you might end up with one or two libraries that might have personal computers on them. But you certainly wouldn't see anything like we had today. And so part of the issue that we ran into is that as we started bringing in new services to the library to the library district, our buildings really weren't built to accommodate them. You know, that we'd have a long wall that would have two outlets on the wall, mostly for vacuum cleaners. I mean, that was the reason that they were put on there. There was just no conception that we would need electricity for anything else. So like, for example, I remember when I was at Blue Spring South and we brought in the card catalogs, they thought about where they wanted to put the card catalogs, but it really wasn't a good location. And so they'd actually dug a trench with these covered up holes that we could actually, you know, sort of pull everything to, but it wasn't going to work. We hadn't allocated enough space back then. They really didn't know. I mean, they thought maybe because computers were so expensive, they thought, well, we might put out two catalogs. It's like they ended up putting out something like eight or something. So there wasn't enough space. And so we ended up having to completely abandon that trench that was put in during construction and then run, you know, an auxiliary pole down from the ceiling in order to install our initial catalog machines. And that was true throughout a lot of our libraries. You know, the other issue is that Max, when he built our buildings, said he was a CB and he did a lot of really cool things, but he didn't really build things to last. I mean, he was part of a building generation that kind of, you know, built the strip malls with the idea that once they're beyond their use, we'll build them with a useful life of 20 years and then they'll tear them down and build something new. So, I mean, I'll never forget. I actually saw him do this once where he pulled up to our parking lot. And the thing about Max is that everyone who knew him always said that, you know, he always arrived, you know, 2 seconds before his car did, because he did. I mean, what would happen is he'd be driving up into a parking lot and before the car actually stopped, you'd see the door swing open and he'd jump out. I have no idea how the vehicle stopped, but it always stopped and somehow, but it always seemed like he arrived just 2 seconds before his car did. And he did that. And, he walked up to a spot and he sort of tapped this spot with his foot. And he said, yeah, that's good enough. Let's go ahead and pour the foundation. And so that was his extent of sort of compaction testing. You know, today we actually bring out engineers and they do all kinds of reports and certifications. Max would just tap his foot and say, okay, it's time to pour. And, you know, because of that, we've actually had to go back and do a lot of repairs to our foundations. You know, it's not really to speak ill of him or his methods or his motivation. I mean, the board at the time was happy with what was happening. They were happy with how he was bringing in the buildings. And in all honesty, the board at the time never expected us to be in these buildings. I mean, they expected to build these things in the 1980s. And then by 2010 or so, we'd all be in brand new buildings, you know, built roughly the same way, maybe in the same neighborhoods. They just never expected us to be in them. And it's one of the reasons why all of our old buildings, our legacy buildings during the building program, all had 10-year roofs on them, because they didn't expect us to, they didn't buy a roof with a warranty beyond 10 years because they didn't expect us to be in the building beyond 10 years. So, you know, it's really, really different sort of attitude. But yeah, I mean, it circled around and talked about a lot of different things, but the truth is, I think a lot of people were really happy with the building when they got them. But I think that as we started exploring more types of services, even basic services like children's services, you know, our adult programming and community programming, all of those sorts of things, as people's appetites and attitudes begin to change about how they wanted library service, they began to find our buildings a little inadequate.
So with the buildings that have recently been built, just from a planning and architectural standpoint, the building we are sitting in right now, the Midwest Genealogy Center, the Woodneath Library Center, which opened in 2013, obviously maybe a little more thought went into that than tapping your foot and saying this land is ready to go.
Actually, going back to Platt City.
Yeah.
Platt City is when I really said, I don't want to have to peer or mud jack another building that I authorize. And so yeah, go ahead.
But from like a planning standpoint, you said that the buildings that were built in the 80s and 90s as part of the building campaign and plan were meant to be spaces that were boxes that could eventually be resold. Obviously, the Midwest Genealogy Center is a very specific building. Obviously, the Woodneath Library Center is a very specific building. Is that the thought process with any type of architectural or building project that MidContinent would do in the future, is that it's going to be more specific to maybe the needs of the public or the needs of the service that they would require?
Yeah, it's always hard for me to say exactly what we'll do in the future, because it's like I say to people all the time, my crystal ball is not clear enough really to know all of that. But yeah, to your point, I would say yes. I mean, because when I was growing up in the library system and I was learning about building library buildings around the Kearney branch and the new Lone Jack branch, I mean, that's when I was really beginning to get more engaged around some of that stuff, when as I became a system employee as opposed to a branch employee. When I was learning about those, we really were still thinking, as the architect was drawing out the plans, we were really thinking, okay, yeah, we know that we've commissioned you to build a library, but what we're really thinking about is what other purposes can this building serve? I mean, even before we put in the first row of shelving, we were thinking about what is the value of this building on the market when we resell it in 10 years. And while it's an interesting way to approach things, it probably is a little, it's a little too far sighted in that you're not really building the building for its purpose. The other thing is that, libraries really have changed as what they are in the 21st century. I mean, compared to what they were in the 20th century or the 19th century. I mean, probably reference service is one of the biggest areas that you can see that difference. I mean, in order to have a great reference collection, you had to have a lot of space. You had to have longitudinal collections of books, and you had to keep them forever, and they could never go anywhere. It's one of the reasons why the Midwest Genealogy Center is built as it is, because it is a reference library in a way, but you don't have collections like these all over the United States. And so you can justify doing this here. In our libraries, we were doing this for our reference collections, big longitudinal collections of reference, and eventually people stopped using them for a number of different reasons, but one of the best reasons is that information went online, mm-hmm. and quality information went online. And so as I look at what I can access through my smartphone that I have, I mean, I can access more information and better quality information through my smartphone than I could at my undergraduate library. I'm not sure that I can say that about my graduate school library, because I mean, Ellis is a pretty impressive library, but it's definitely better than what I could get at UMKC as an undergraduate. And when I was working on my MPA, I remember I took this class called Economics for Administrators or something like it. It was a straight econ class. And the professor stood up in class and he said, you know, I really don't know how you do this, but there's this one online resource that you've got to get access to. We don't have it at Miller Nichols, but this place called Mid-Continent Library has access to it. And so if you can figure out how to get a library card, that's what you need. And that's going to be the most important resource that you're going to need for our entire class. And so this is where online went to. I mean, online went so that it was, and reference and that sort of service got to the point that if you really wanted to be effective, you had to be digital. For that sort of information. And being digital doesn't really take up any space. And so then what you start looking at is, okay, so how does the community want to use a library if they don't need rows and rows of tables and study tables and rows of books? They don't need to be a warehouse for storing material. What is a library? And so what I came to conclude after working on our strategic plan and things like that is that people tend to see the library as a place, but also as a service. And the service part, we've kind of been talking about that idea that the library can be a place that can be a really, really strong information service, can be delivered through your smartphone. But in terms of the library being a place, people see it as a third place, as a place that you go that's not necessarily your home and not necessarily your work. It's a place where people come to collaborate and where they come to build community. And collaboration, I mean, it's nothing fancy. I mean, what I'm talking about there is, you know, maybe you're on a PTA committee or a church committee or something, and you just don't want to take people to your house because your house is a wreck. Well, you can come to the library and do that. Or in some cases, there's more important community building conversations going on. Like we've had several conversations about the future of energy and energy reliance and independence that's been going on at the North Independence branches, which is fabulous. I mean, it's incredible. But where else would you have a conversation like that? I mean, if someone was posting that we want to have a conversation about the future of energy dependence in independence, and we're going to have it at the power plant, well, you're pretty sure you know what we're going to come up with there. I mean, we're going to do more of the same, because why would they want to change? And if you did it at City Hall, then you think that they might have a particular angle on this. Or if you did it at, you know, a place like the Sermon Center here in Independence, but it was sponsored by the Sierra Club, you know, probably a whole lot of solar panels would be going up, would be the answer to it. And you would know that even before you went, right? The thing about a library is that a library is sort of an independent, sort of agnostic, sort of a place where people can come and hear all sides and then hopefully come to a decision. And that's a reputation that we have. And that's a reputation that we have from our old print collection days. And we can build on that and build a stronger community. That's part of what our community conversations and community engagement initiative is around that. And I think that that's probably the better way to use a library. And so the thing is that you can build a new library with intentional spaces for certain types of users where they will not encroach on each other. So right now, our big warehouse buildings, you know, you get a particularly rambunctious group of kids in a story time and they take over the whole building. I mean, their noise just doesn't. They can't help that. You can build a building where it is more intentional and people can have more private space and more collaborative space. But you can also do that so that it could theoretically still be repurposed and used for other things. But the way that I'm looking at buildings is I'm not looking at them first about what is their resale value. I'm initially looking at, you know, how can we provide the best service for people and then hopefully not build ourselves into a corner. You know, a building like Woodneath, like you mentioned before, I mean, because of its historic nature, nothing's happening there. I mean, you know, but theoretically, and this is just theoretically, just speculation. I don't think we're going anywhere in Smithville for 20 or 30 years, but the way the Smithville building is built you know, I could see where you could repurpose this, the new Smithville building, in some other ways. I mean, it's built very well to serve as a library, a 21st century library.
Colonial.
It is. In terms of its outside architecture, but you go inside and, you know, it's got some high ceilings, take down a couple of the sheetrock walls. I mean, they're not structural, and you've got a great big open space, and it could become an office complex. It could become an incubator. It could become, you know, maybe you could have food service on the side that has the drive up, and you could have, you know, some other application on the other side. And so, I mean, I could see where that building could be repurposed a whole lot easier than something like Woodneath or something like the Midwest Genealogy Center could be. But that conversation, I'm just brainstorming right now today. That conversation has never happened before today.
So I shouldn't take my sledgehammer into Smithville tomorrow and start knocking down the wall.
No, please. Okay. No. We're not going anywhere in Smithville for many, many years.
Yeah. That's a beautiful building too. So,
and something you touched on earlier was the unique nature of having the Genealogy Center in our system. If you could take us through the history of the Genealogy Center, where it started and how we got to the building we're in.
I'll tell you the John Ferguson version of the story, because there's lots of different creation stories around the Midwest Genealogy Center. But the John Ferguson version of the story starts with the creation of the Genealogy and Local History Department that was part of the North Independence Branch. And so, when I asked him the very same question, basically what he went to was, in the mid-70s, people were looking to discover family histories. And a lot of that had to do with the popularity of Alex Haley's Roots, not just the miniseries on television, which was incredible. But even before the television show, people were really interested from his book, that people had read his book and they were really taken by it. And it became more popular. Genealogy as an avocation became much more popular. And so responding to customer demand and customer suggestion and recommendation, we started building the genealogy collection, and started building it at North Independence, because North Independence really served as our central reference collection for the. We didn't have a main library, but our central reference collection was the North Independence branch. So it made sense that we would try to house it there. A minor connection, it's probably not as big a connection as people like to assume it is, but a minor reason we were able to sort of get critical mass behind this was the large population of LDS churches in the Independence and Jackson County area for lots of reasons. I mean, historically, this is an important area for that faith. And I think that, and because genealogy and family history is an important part of their theology, we had sort of a little bit of a built-in market. And so we continued to build. And the thing about genealogy, and this is what I kept telling people when I was actually campaigning for this building, was that you never throw anything away. You can't throw anything away with genealogy. It's not like, you know, a novel, you know, a certain novel, you read it, falls out of favor. Eventually you weed all the copies because no one wants to read it anymore. When you get a passenger list, you never get rid of the passenger list. So what ends up happening is that a genealogy collection grows. So it started off in half of the basement at North Independence. There was a basement at North Independence, and we just reopened it after we remodeled it. But it was in one half of the basement. So one half had genealogy, the other half had magazines. And then what ended up happening is they pushed the magazines out and took over the entire basement. And it was still growing. And so then they built the collection, or they built the addition at the that's connected to North Independence. What is now sort of the children's library and the computer lab, that was the genealogy collection for a long time, and started to outgrow that collection as that space as well. And what
I see where this is going.
Yeah. So what ends up happening? Not only do you not throw things away, when you gain a reputation as being a premier resource, people look to donate to you as well. And so that became the other issue. When we did the 91 levy shift, which that's when we, the building levy ended and we sort of shifted the money, and it gets confusing. But when we did that, one of the things we promised to do as part of that was to buy the 1920 census on microfilm. At that particular time, through various initiatives, Mid-Continent Public Library had every edition of the U.S. Census on microfilm, except for the 1920, and it was getting ready to come out. When we bought the 1920 census, it was us, the Mormon Collection in Salt Lake City, and the National Archives were the only three places in the United States that had all of the census. So yeah, by the time we got to 1990, what it sort of started off as a sort of local local response to customer needs had become, you know, a premier collection, one of three places that you could go in order to get certain bits of information. In fact, little known trivia fact, you might want to, you know, hang on to this for a contest or something someday. That when Ancestry.com, and you know, as you go online and you see Ancestry always showing things about going onto the census, every one of those images for the U.S. Census that's on Ancestry.com was actually photographed from the Mid-Continent collection. We actually loaned our rolls of microfilm census to, well, it wasn't Ancestry at that time, it was ProQuest, but we loaned them all to ProQuest, one roll at a time. They digitized them, and then they spun off that product that became Ancestry.com. And so all of those actually originated here at Mid-Continent Public Library. We got something in exchange for that. Don't worry.
Just a free service.
No, it was not a free service.
Is there any sort of branch building mishaps or anything? It doesn't have to be mishaps, but any kind of...
You're on the wrong side of the street. You realized halfway through. Yeah.
Wild and crazy hijinks associated with the building program.
Push the building off. Foundation maybe.
Yeah, no building off the foundation, but yeah, there've been more than a handful of mishaps that have occurred over the course of the building project. My first branch that I went to out of library school was Blue Springs, what was now called Blue Springs South. It was just called Blue Springs back then. And when I went, and I was looking at the back wall at one point, I noticed that it kind of looked weird. And I'd also noticed that there appeared to be a live power line running through the back of the, just laying on top of the ground, and thought it should at least be buried. So I contacted somebody and I said, you know, while I was back there, I kind of noticed this wall looked different. They said, yeah, it's because it fell down. I said, fell down? And I said, yeah, halfway through construction, the wall, as they were doing the masonry work and building up the wall, just fell down. It just wasn't properly supported. And so that happened. And, you know, there were lots of odd little things that would happen like that. I mean, you build 30 buildings, you're going to run into some to weird things from time to time. One of the things that happened, we really worked differently when we did Platte City. Platte City was when we really started to divert from our traditional form, where we really started looking at building something that was going to be a little bit more intentional, you know, as with a little bit more intentional spaces, and not something that we're looking at, okay, so what's this going to be when we leave it? And you can tell that. I mean, when you go into Platte City, it's a very different building compared to the other buildings, the legacy buildings in our collection. One of the things we did at Platte City that was different was it was built with cast concrete walls, as opposed to brick and block, which was our standard form. And so the cast concrete walls actually allow us to, like, it's designed so we can build another 5,000 square foot building on the back without getting into the drive-through lane and all of that. And what you're supposed to be able to do is disconnect those cast concrete walls and sort of pick them up and sort of swing them out and then build like a new glass on the back is basically the way it's supposed to work. That was cool. I mean, that's something that we hadn't really done before or anything like that. But we also built that most, if not all of that building was built on a geogrid, which again was something, you know, we weren't tapping our foot on the ground. We were actually looking at, you know, building things state. We knew through some environmental studies that we had done. Again, environmental studies, which we would never have done under the old way. We knew that that was actually an old dump site for KCI. And so so you went down about, you know, 20 feet underground and you'd find old pieces of runway and stuff like that.
Wow.
Okay. And so what we started doing is as we were laying out the building, we started trying to figure out, okay, what part's landfill, what part's not, what part's undisturbed. And as we came across a landfill, we'd actually try to drill down and get into bedrock beyond the landfill. And then we built everything on a geogrid too, which both those things stabilized. It was the first time we'd ever done anything like that. And, you know, so far, you know, knock wood, so far we have not had any sort of building movement there like we've experienced in a lot of our legacy buildings. But one of the things that we did discover there was that our electrician was just a nightmare. We almost we almost missed opening the building. You know, it was one of these things where we sort of backed out the opening of the building, and we didn't, you know, we backed out, then we added additional time, and we were still, I mean, we were coming up on opening the building, and we were still weeks behind in terms of the electricity there, or the electrical runs. And I think the initial inspection, I think it failed, the initial inspection for electrical. I mean, it was just a major, and the thing that I keep waiting for is, you know, we keep our eye really close on all the electrical there, because I just got this gut feeling we're going to have to rewire the whole building one day. And that was a lesson that I learned, is that it doesn't matter what lessons you learn on the previous building project. You'll have a whole new set of lessons to learn on the next building project. So my next building project after, because I was involved in Platte City. Actually, I was involved in the initial layout and a lot of the initial work in Platte City. And then my next project was the Midwest Genealogy Center, where we really did take a deviation from that. And man, this one was a tough one, because basically what we were trying to do is we were trying to get this building open for the NGS, the National Genealogical Society, which was meeting in Kansas City in May of 2008. And by the time they broke ground, as I remember, that we broke ground in spring of 2006, I want to say, or 2007. But at any rate, incredible short window to build a 52,000 square foot building. We ended up, got everything all prepped. Everything was going well. Drilled our piers so that everything was going to be good with our foundation. Had a great electrician on site. Everything was good there. And ready for the structural steel to go up, and it didn't show up. And it ended up that our structural steel was several weeks late. And amazingly, it was the exact amount late that if it would have come on time, we would have opened in May for the NGS reception. Instead, we opened on, I think it was June the 21st or something like that. So we missed it by about a month, but it was in good enough shape that we could get a temporary permit. We actually bussed people in here from Kansas City, and they were able to walk around and see what it was going to look like. And so it was a big hit. But in that one, I learned, okay, so you watch the steel. You watch the steel real closely. And let's see, then our next building project was Smithville. And at Smithville, if you've been to Smithville, you see it sets up real high, and there's this big retaining wall that kind of sets everything in place, which we had to do. And because it's set up so high, we put in a geogrid cloth, which means that you built a couple of courses of brick, and then you'd lay back this fabric cloth into the hillside, and you'd, you know, roll over and tamp it down. And so basically this cloth was holding the wall in place through the weight of the hillside. And so we get the wall up, and we're starting to work on it, and then the wall falls down. And part of the issue that we discover is that the geogrid isn't properly put in place. And the problem at this point is that the parking lot's done. So you can't really take out all that asphalt and dig everything back out and relay it in the way that you're supposed to. And so that became a big headache. And, you know, again, something we never in a million years would have thought about, but, you know, electricity worked fine in that one. Foundation worked fine. Got the steel on time. This time it was the wall. North Independence renovation ended up the. There were several things that were problems there, but I think one of the big problems, and part of that was because we were sort of marrying together three buildings that were built over 35 years, and so there was lots of little things that came up. But one of them that we were looking to do was to level out the floors. The floors were in terrible. Again, you know, it's floor foundation issues, just like we were talking about everywhere else. So we're looking to level out the floors. And what ended up happening is that they just way underbid the floor levelization. And so that ended up actually taking a big chunk out of it. And, you know, the subcontractor that was responsible for that called me an idiot. And, you know, it was all kinds of interesting things happening. But again, never in a million years would have thought about that one. And then, you know, Woodneath, the one there, again, steel was in good shape, electricity, got great electrical contractors, didn't have to build any retaining walls, so we were feeling good there. Didn't have to level any floors, feeling great. We had to jump through a lot of hoops in terms of historic preservation, which was interesting. But then we start getting to the 11th hour and the landscaping's not going in and the trees aren't going in. And every time we start to look at getting, we get this unseasonable snow. I mean, we had snow.
I remember like May 1st it snowed.
May 1st it snowed. Yeah. And in April it snowed. I mean, and that was the winter that we had like 2 12-inch snows and in a 2 week period or something, just crazy snow, which kind of kept the landscape guy from getting into his fields. He said, we don't know. But it ended up that, he was there. I think we opened that one for sake of argument, let's say the 22nd of June, he was out there until like midnight on the 21st, still putting sod down. And we did not think that we were going to get occupancy and we did not think that we were actually going to get open. And, somehow we did. And, we're still actually now, almost 2 years later, we're still actually working on the landscape and getting that fixed at Woodney. So that was the big lesson that I learned, is that no matter what you learn on the previous project, the headache on the next project will be something completely unforeseen.